The 1999 Salt Lake Sunstone Symposium presents Session 256, a paper entitled Democratic Theocracy or Theocratic Democracy, The Tensions of Church Government and Governance by Mary Ann Morgan.
Lavina Fielding Anderson for suggesting the exercise to me. Let's read the last scripture in this way and see if we have any new insights as to how democracy functions in the church today. Appoint among yourselves a teacher, and let not all be spokeswomen at once, but let one speak at a time, and let all listen unto her sayings, that all may have spoken, that when all have spoken, that all may be edified of all, and let every woman, and that every woman may have an equal privilege. One of the most important aspects of a democratic society is equality of opportunity. Feminism has brought us many new insights into the inequalities of opportunity and power that for years have been unquestioned. Unfortunately, if one is even to question some of those practices in the church today, one is immediately labeled a troublemaker. To question current policy is synonymous with criticism, currently a shameful sin. The door to discussion is shut, and often the woman who tries to open it is severely punished. No wonder attendance of women at their specific auxiliaries is at an all-time low. It is hoped that the current environment will change. Interestingly, one of Mormonism's most important doctrines depends upon a man and a woman cooperating and sharing power equally. Section 131 of the Doctrine and Covenants tells us that it is only together in the new and everlasting covenant of marriage that men and women can reach ultimate exaltation. That doctrine prescribes there be no dominion or compulsion to any degree in the relationship. As a man and woman negotiate that relationship over years together, only a democratic orientation tempered by love can bring healthy personal growth to both parties. And so, according to Mormon theology, learning to live together democratically is the best way to achieve a successful to arrive at successful individual growth. I started this paper by noting that theocracy and democracy existing together within the gospel of Jesus Christ is paradoxical. That there aren't more problems is actually quite remarkable. Of course there are problems, but it is commendable that people still pick up the problems and the unmet expectations and keep trying. That is what life is all about. Institutions like marriage and the church are slowly changing, and of course change brings tension. What is the optimum relationship between theocracy and democracy? Is the relationship the same from ward to ward? Should it be? Can it be? How does it or should it evolve as people mature with respect to the institution and within families? How can a ward meet the needs of different people at different stages of development? How can an untrained lay clergy administer programs without mistakes? The answer, of course, is that it can't. But as with our personal problems, we must continue to learn, to forgive the mistakes of others as well as our own, and try and make ourselves right with God and begin again to negotiate the problems in better ways. Arguably, the most significant change in Mormon doctrine in the 20th century was the June 1978 acceptance of all males as potential priesthood holders. Despite the fact that our Constitution guaranteed equal access under the law to all people, it took a bloody civil war to start the changes which actually mandated equal access. Especially during the 60s and even today, blacks still struggle to participate fully in our country's democracy. Our church was even slower to mandate those spiritually democratic opportunities for all men, but the changes did come. Some women are now making the same case. As with the issue of black males, there is much rancor, disagreement, and fear of change. People on both sides of the issue quote scripture and precedent to prove their points. The issue is so emotionally charged that discussions about change don't even take place, say, for instance, in a Relief Society meeting, where one might expect to find discussion by women of women's issues. It is as though women are either afraid, or what appears to be the case, those active and called to leadership positions have no desire for change. For those who do, excommunication is a pretty effective tool to silence discussion. The current climate feels more theocratic than democratic. While I accept that any change for the church must come from the prophet, I find it disheartening that institutional punishment follows those who would question, study, and discuss. For it is free and democratic give and take of ideas that fosters learning, irrespective of one's beliefs. The day-to-day administration of wards and stakes provides the workplace for both theocratic and democratic government. While staff callings are made from the top, they often come by way of requests from a person heading up an organization further down the hierarchy. There is a democratic checks and balances part of the church government, too, provided by the sustaining of people in church jobs. I have been told that it actually worked as a democratic exercise in the early church. Now, however, it seems pretty perfunctory. To illustrate some tension between the theocratic and democratic, let me share some situations of which I have been caught in the middle. As a primary chorister, I attempted to teach a Negro spiritual children's song to our primary. This was pre-1978. Never mind that we had given our annual sacrament meeting program with its prescribed songs, all of which the children had learned. As a worker who had been set apart to be inspired in my calling, I was excited to bring something from my professional life which I thought would provide a quality experience. Musically first rate, appropriate for children's voices, a lesson in another culture with a beautiful message about God that was not antithetical to Mormon beliefs, was what the song offered. I introduced it one week, and before the next primary, I was called in by the primary president and asked not to continue. Teach only from the primary songbook was the instruction from the handbook. Seems to me that that damn handbook is administered as though it were the last word, and if it is administered as though it were the last word, can put a damper on some good, even inspired ideas. As the music chairman of our ward, I decided that we had the capability to produce Handel's Messiah at Christmas. I knew that the church handbook cautioned us not to use brass instruments in the chapel. But I also knew that the Hallelujah Chorus and the Trumpet Shall Sound would both be rendered puny without the brass. I figured that if I asked, I knew what the answer would be. If I could get away with it, I knew that the spiritual result would justify my including brass in the orchestra. Besides, one is pretty arrogant to try to second-guess the orchestrations of Handel, who testified of divine intervention when writing that oratorio. Just as I had hoped, the music spoke for itself, and the ward members were so spiritually uplifted that they wanted to do the Messiah the next Christmas and the next. After having done the Messiah in our ward for about 8 years, several years ago we did our presentation the week before Christmas, as Christmas that year happened to be on a Sunday, and it was thought that such a production would be overwhelming on Christmas Day. To make the Christmas Day Sunday better than an ordinary Sunday, I arranged for a musical solo as well as a trumpet solo by a member of our ward who would play still, still, still with his trumpet muted. Upon seeking advice from a higher authority, our new bishop came to me and said that he had been counseled by his authority that we couldn't have the brass solo in the chapel. I reminded him that we had been having brass in the chapel for the last 8 years, including the previous week, and that the same authority had been there each time, even speaking over the pulpit about how inspirational the music was. Shouldn't the criterion be spiritual uplift and opportunity for members rather than instrumentation? In the end, theocratic rule scored one more point against democracy. A third example of the democracy versus theocracy problem came several years ago when I was asked to prepare a young women's choir for state conference. The stake president had requested the Crusaders hymn, which was in the primary songbook. I was to choose two other pieces that would be subject to his approval, which I did. So much for democratic trust. I chose the Shaker hymn, Simple Gifts, and St. James Eyre, a lovely folk setting of the 23rd Psalm. After a couple weeks of practicing 4 days a week and 1 week before the conference, a member of the stake presidency called to apologize about the change in plans, but the visiting area authority wanted hymns from the hymn book. Could we change? I reminded him that the stake president's choice, Crusader's hymn, wasn't in our hymn book, and that with only 1 week to go, it was too late to present a polished performance of new material. Besides, wasn't the Lord's my shepherd, I'll not want, He makes me down to lie in pastures green. He leadeth me the quiet waters by. Essentially, the same thing is, the Lord is my shepherd. No want shall I know. I feed in green pastures, save folded I rest. My superior agreed with me that it was, but he still wanted the hymns from our hymnal. I reminded him that we had just spent $100 to have string parts printed for the accompaniment, and besides, we were only a week away. And not only that, I wailed, the music was appropriate. It was beautiful, nearly prepared, and had been approved by this very state presidency of which he was a part. He kept saying that he agreed with me. Couldn't he just explain to the area president about the situation and go for hymns the next time? He could even add some hymns to what we were preparing. Apparently not. I learned that day that in our church, when authority speaks, it can even take precedence over good common sense. So as to allow what the area president wanted, we sang simple gifts as prelude music. Although hard for me to figure it out, it was okay at 9:55, but inappropriate at 10 o'clock. I added a hymn onto St. James Air in medley fashion so that we would have a hymn from the actual hymn book, rendering the St. James Air acceptable. The Crusaders hymn was allowed because, quote, the state president had requested it, unquote. The preceding experience almost seemed surreal to me in its attempts to please authority. It was hard to believe I was actually having the conversation I was having. I think of myself as being a loyal, cooperative person who will bend and make exceptions for good reason, but I felt used and cheapened to agree to such ridiculous behavior. The incident made me want to take my gifts elsewhere. In any job, but particularly in a volunteer situation, people don't want to feel like pawns. While using our gifts to help others helps us grow, carrying out someone else's agenda when we don't agree is worse than classic codependency. That kind of behavior actually retards growth. In her book, Revolution from Within, Gloria Steinem, in fact, this is so good, I'm just going to read a couple of pages from her own book, Gloria Steinem. Bell, a town in a rough and rural part of eastern Oklahoma with about 300 mostly Cherokee families, had no school that went above the eighth grade, little indoor plumbing, a lot of conflict, and widespread hopelessness. Because residents were dependent upon government handouts and threatened as invisible and treated as invisible to the outside world, they had come to feel powerless over their fates, adults with all their vulnerabilities of childhood and none of the rewards. The few who managed to escape were often ashamed to admit that they lived in Bell. When Wilma Mankiller, a Cherokee community renewal leader, said she wanted to start a project there, she received two warnings from the people who knew Bell. First, these people would never work, much less volunteer to help themselves, and second, she shouldn't stay in town after nightfall. Nonetheless, she posted notices in Cherokee and English asking people to come to a town meeting to discuss what you would like Bell to look like in 10 years. No one came. She called another meeting. A handful of residents came, but only to complain. She called a third, and convinced now that she really wanted to listen, about a dozen people showed up. I've always trusted disenfranchised people to come up with their own ideas, Wilma later recalled. Therefore, she didn't dictate or even suggest. She just asked a question. What single thing would change this community the most? The answer was not a project for school dropouts or any other program to help young people who still had a hope of escaping Bell, which was what Wilma had expected. Instead, they chose something that was more democratic and crucial to everyone, regardless of age or intention to leave, a water supply that was connected to every house, including indoor plumbing. This would cut school dropout rates, too, as they explained to Wilma. Their kids had to bathe in polluted streams or in water carried from a single spigot outside the schoolhouse. And when they failed to bathe, as often as their less poor classmates in Stillwell, the neighboring town where the nearest high school was, they were ridiculed. Just as Wilma had started this process with a question that gave residents the power of choice, she continued it with a bargain that gave them an equal role in what they had chosen. She would get the supplies, federal government, engineers, federal support, engineers, and other experts, but only if the residents built the water system themselves and also helped with the fundraising. After generations of broken promises, they were full of skepticism about outside help, and after generations of passivity, also full of self-doubt, nonetheless, they named themselves the Bell Water and Housing Project and began. Each family was assigned a mile of pipe to lay. Those who knew English also worked on fundraising plans, and those who spoke Cherokee did everything from making the path of ditches to carrying sand for backfill. But all knew their jobs were vital to the project. Though the women had been just part of the woodwork, as Wilma put it, and were also convinced they were too weak to carry pipe or to do construction tasks, they soon discovered it wasn't any harder than carrying water to their usual household chores. Wilma knew the group's spirits had begun to rise when the family started to relay race to see who could lay the pipe the fastest. Though failure had been the unanimous prediction of Bell's neighbors, people were from surrounding communities came to see what was happening. So did several foundation executives who viewed this renewal project as an example of third world development. Certainly few places in the world were poorer than Bell. When a local CBS television crew, attracted by Bell's reliable scenes of poverty, came to film powerlessness, they played an inadvertent role in changing the situation by letting residents see themselves on the evening news and begin to feel less isolated. So soon, even the non-Indian residents of Bell were saying positive things about this water project in the newspaper, and the Indian community began to feel visible for the first time. Most important, they had become visible through something they were doing for themselves. And it goes on. It's a fun thing to read, but where people were given true democratic opportunities, the first time a project actually made sense to them. Surely my experiences are different from others, but it does seem to me that more democratic trust from the people on the bottom by those in authoritative positions might be a healthy corrective in the church today. As people are set apart for their church callings, they are blessed with the responsibility and divine power for carrying out these jobs, keys, if you will. And just as it is important to have faith in our leaders, it is equally important to have faith that followers will seek divine guidance in carrying out their stewardships. We hear many prayers for leaders, and while I don't want to criticize that, it strikes me that a prayer to bless all of the followers would be so unusual that it would cause people to raise their eyebrows. We're so conditioned to hearing about obedience to those who administer over us that we sometimes fail to have faith in our own abilities to solve problems or even to think creatively. Every so often we hear a letter read from the pulpit asking church members not to burden the general authorities with personal concerns or favors. Part of the problem, I believe, however, rests with those same authorities when they promote a rigid hierarchy of power where a member's ability to act in democratic or authentic ways is undermined. Whenever I hear follow the brethren, I wish I would be hearing follow Christ or follow your conscience. Promoting individual growth rather than hierarchical blind obedience just seems healthier. If we put our faith in the arm of flesh, we might as well take the responsibility of having it be our own. Although many will argue that church is a theocracy, I believe that one can make a pretty good case that it is a democracy too. I submit that seeing is believing, and because we see more hierarchical theocracy played out, that is what many have come to expect and to believe is the only way to do business. Just as totalitarian governments are painfully giving way to democratic ones, we're reminded that all institutions are having their power structures challenged. With democratic rights established, the Restoration brought more good news to and about the common person than religion had offered for centuries. If this dispensation is to be about fullness, then the gifts of every child of God need to be treasured. I believe that Joseph Smith was a visionary when he said, "We teach them correct principles and let them govern themselves." Thank you.
We still have quite a bit of time, and Marianne specifically asked that the time be turned over to all of you to share your thoughts, ask questions. Maybe we could carry on a discussion. although we do need to come up here and carry on the discussion over the mic so it gets taped. So you're welcome to come up.
Not a question, but an observation and then your response to it. Referring to your situation with the area authority and preparation of songs and feeling cheap and used, was it because you didn't follow your own conscience?
Well, you know, at that point, it seemed to me that it was ridiculous to have it blow up into a big fight. And so, you know, what they were asking was such a ridiculous thing that it wasn't worth a fight. And so it was just easier to acquiesce. But again, you know, I just felt like I have considerable gifts to offer, and I'm not going to play this game any longer. And so I went to the public schools, and I've been, you know, doing a music program in the public schools in an inner city school. And I just think that's what's going to happen a lot of times in the church. You know, if they don't want me the way I am, that's fine. They don't have to have me. But the loss is theirs.
So you don't have a church calling?
Well, I do have a church calling. I'm a visiting teacher, and I've just been called. We just moved to a new ward, and I've been called as the homemaking leader in my ward. They always call me to positions that don't require me to do much talking.
Yes, Marianne. First of all, I just wanted to say that for about 10 years running, I've been voting for Marianne to be a bishop. Thus far, it has not occurred. And I also had the privilege of serving with Marianne on the board of directors at Sunstone. She's a terrific advocate. She lives the issues that she talks about. I'm interested in comments because I know I'm personally discouraged as that we can influence much the cultures or the institutions attempt to become more democratic, particularly given that since people you know, who get to real power have been there so long. And I haven't seen movements. I also know that they're frustrated because people pigeonhole them and put them into boxes and put them in roles. I mean, everything works both ways. But do you have any, or even the group, have suggestions, comments about how we can become a more democratic, open culture?
Personally, I think it's very difficult to say very much in your own ward, because if you're always harping on these things, you get labeled as kind of a harpy. And so you have to be very, very careful. I think what's going to change the situation, you know, apparently there's a lot of inactivity. And, you know, the church authorities have got to be asking why. And I think if they treat people the way, you know, some of these examples are, you know, people are saying, I don't need this. You know, I think as we get older and mature in our wards, you know, I personally don't get as much out of the meetings as I did when I was younger. And a lot of the things I hear seem awfully naive and I don't agree with, and it's hard to sit through some of the stuff. But I won't say that if I don't go with a good attitude, I don't almost always come back, you know, spiritually renewed too. So I think we have a responsibility not always to be takers. We should be givers too. But I don't want to be a codependent giver. I want to be an authentic giver of my gifts. And to the extent that I can stay in the ward and do that and not exit, I mean, to me, those are the real issues. You know, if when I was called to this homemaking, you know, one of the homemaking committee, one of the things of advice I was given is that they're having a very difficult time getting women to come out to homemaking meeting. Well, then maybe it's past his time. You know, maybe it's time to change. So, I don't know. What ideas do other people have? Come up into the mic if you...
I think some of the basic demographics and globalization of the church are going to have impact on democratization. That is, it's one thing to be highly hierarchical on a church of 5 million or even 10 million as we are now. But if we're going to be a church of 25 million and 50 million and 100 million, just organizationally, there's only so many things you can control when you get that large. So I think demographics will be one thing. The other thing, of course, is as we become a mass presence in some other cultures, that the force of other cultures will force some at least decentralization, if not democratization. I mean, the two aren't necessarily synonymous, but I think some of those larger forces of demographics and differing cultures will be large forces that will cause some breakdown of as a rigid model we have now.
I think one of the problems is not just theocracy, but it's hierarchy. So as these rigid follow-what-I-tell-you-to-do models permeate the church, then you can grow to 5 million and 10 million and 100 million, and sometimes local authorities and area authorities still maintain this heavy-handed, you know. So I think the whole culture needs to change. You know, the people that are rewarded with leadership positions are the real rigid ones, and so they perpetuate the same kind of governmental process.
I was taking a methods of seminary teaching course last semester, and I was a TA in philosophy at Arizona State University, so I wasn't able to do the observed teacher training portion of the course. So instead, I interviewed one of my post-Mormon friends. That's a word I've coined for various people I know have left the church for various reasons, usually offended by leaders. So I interviewed her about her seminary experience and made a top 10 list of things she would change if she had the power to do so. And I took down the list, and one thing was to encourage different types of role models for women and incorporate different types of accounts from other women outside the church. And I said, well, what do you have in mind? And he said, like Gloria Steinem, for instance. So I got to buy a tape of this and give it to my friend. That's a little joke to introduce my issue. I guess I was raised in a church out in Texas, and I can't really recount too many experiences with leaders, bishops, or state presidents that were contentious in any way. My mother can, but I suppose that's part of the point. Do you think these type of confrontations happen more with women out of maybe a projected fear that some of these men have who are not too good in dealing with women? And additionally, what can I do as a priesthood holder in the church maybe to leaven the problem that may exist? I hope it's more the case out here where Mormon culture has been a long time and kind of this rigidification has had more time to set in. I think as my experience in Texas and California, especially some of the more cosmopolitan areas of California attest to, that there doesn't seem to be as much authoritarianism. But as much as I have had those experiences since I moved to go to grad school in Arizona, I'm wondering what we can do. You mentioned, you know, building trust. What's the best way to do that when you have a rigid leader? I guess that's my question.
You know, I don't think I would be prepared to say if this kind of behavior happens more to women. Does anybody have a feeling for that? Come up and tell us.
Well, I guess I have a special situation because I raised my daughter as a single parent, single woman. in the church. And then when I was 50, I got married to a man who was 52, and he'd never been married. So we got to compare a lot of notes of 5 decades in the church as single people, you know. And my notes are much more grim than his, you know. So we didn't figure it was singlehood alone. He knew he was a threat to society because he wasn't married, you know. I mean, that was communicated to him through Brigham Young and all, but... but I knew a lot more than that, yeah, and both covertly and overtly. So I would say my notes are so much worse than his. And there are so many other women I've talked to that say, well, yeah, that's true, that I would say it probably happens to women more.
You know, it's thought-provoking, too, for you to say, what can we do? And I think this would generate some good discussion. Does anyone want to come and give some ideas of what suggestions of what can be done? Well, he's coming up. I might say, you know, I think, you know, Mormonism has all kinds of theology for democracy or democratic ways of behaving. So I think from my standpoint, you know, I just sort of, in my ward, see it my way and you know, and share that. And if someone sees it the other way, well, you know, that's another way to see it too. But, you know, I don't back down that my way's wrong or that it isn't Mormon. Because I think our theology is wonderfully open.
Well, I'm not going to answer your question. I was going to address another issue. I think that we've got kind of a paradox. If you're going to be, say, an executive director of an organization, you end up having to have rules, regulations. And as a church... That's the paradox to me. As it grows and increases, then you need structure. And there's something human in the fact that I protect myself, whether I'm in the military, whatever, when I've got rules, regulations. I am now not responsible because I went by the book. And I think as the church has grown, trying to leave it on a local level and let people use their own inspiration, revelation, ends up being contrary to the leader who's there trying to protect themselves. Because it's very easy to say, I went right by the bishop's book, and all of us have been caught in situations in different parts of the nation, wherever we live back east or along the Wasatch Front, that you know that revelation, inspiration, justice as far as what sin is and how you're going to be treated is going to vary from one location to another, clear across the world, Australia, whatever. And then you get into the different cultural problems of, like, music. When I was in the Fiji Islands, the Tahitians were not allowed to do that vulgar dance in Tahiti. But when they got to Fiji, we had no restrictions. So I had everyone from downtown up at the church house watching those wild Tahitians that were in at the Mormon church. But yet they couldn't do the same dance at the Mormon church. However, a circular had just come out in the early 60s saying we were not allowed to have the twist. I had no idea what the twist looked like. And about the time I tried to stop someone at the dance from doing the twist, now I had offended, in this case, some Samoans that were there in their various cultures. That's how they got people to get up and dance. So another paradox was, how do you cross over into other cultures with the Wasatch Front culture? I mean, we can't even relate how we deal in Salt Lake City with Happy Valley around the point of the mountain. It's two different cultures when you get involved. And when you mentioned the music, in 1960, 1965, my bishop of the ward at BYU was professor of music. So guess who had percussion in all our sacrament meetings? Nothing was ever said, and it was just incredible music that went on. I didn't even know it wasn't allowed. But then I'm down with these poor people in Fiji who have nothing but their guitars, and they're allowed to play in their own churches, but I cannot have a guitar to play music where we got a little small branch and they got to hear these horrible voices of two elders trying to screech away to lead music without any accompaniment. And so I think, if anything, hopefully at some point the church will make a change in this democratic process where it can be left up to the locals, where the middle management, which I refer to as the stake presidents, the bishops, regional representatives, don't have to be called on the carpet by someone higher than them and operate in such a rigid function that they don't have to be fearful of their jobs. Mm. And yet, ironically enough, how does one gravitate within the Mormon Church? And except by obedience. And another paradox, I've got to have loyal obedience to these principles, and that's what the prayers go out. Let's, be with the leaders, but we've lost a whole lot with the democratic principles that we need to be guided by, which initially were in the church when it started.
I think we could all come up with horror stories about what goes on here and what can't go on. And when you think of a lay church, I mean, we're just a bunch of people who have never had any training in doing this. It is amazing. It works as well as it does. In fact, as I wrote this paper and I thought of all these ridiculous examples I put in, and I didn't put any examples of wonderful experiences I've had, which far outnumber these. And so, in a way, it's kind of unfair. But by the same token, I want it to be better. This is my culture. This is my heritage and my church. We deserve better. We should be better. Just like for your own family, you want the best, not because you don't care, because you care deeply. I'm troubled by the people that say, oh, Sunstone turns so many people away from the church. I don't think it's Sunstone that turns people away from the church. It's the heavy-handed reaction to people that come to Sunstone that turns them away. And that's a message that they don't understand.
I think this question that is raised back here and by you is at the heart of what's happening as we enter the 21st century in the local ward. I think the frustration is increasing. I feel like I have much to give in my ward, but I feel like if I share it, that there's a lot of people that don't wish to receive it. I refer to those people as mushroom Mormons. They are kept in the dark and like to be fed you know what, but some of them actually like it. I don't know what to do about them. I think I can tolerate them. I'm not sure they can tolerate me. When my wife died and I remarried, I told my new wife I couldn't leave, because after 20 years these people are just getting so they liked me, and I couldn't start all over again. I think we have this penchant with unity at all levels of the church. You see it at the highest levels, where one of the 12 will say something, and others, because of unity or wishing not to show any disunity, will not say anything. And so really, when you talk about a hierarchy, often it's just one person who's spoken out, and because the others do not, that's what stands. On the local level, I come from a ward that there's some very, very bright people in it. But it seems like their IQ drops about 100 points or 40 points at least when they come to church. Federal judge recently told me in my ward that provocative is out. And maybe part of the answer is to talk in terms of education, that contention is really not of the devil. It's the spirit of contention that is of the devil. And I think to contend for what we feel and what we believe in is something that I think is worth fighting for, and I think it's necessary if we're going to feel comfortable in our own wards. I was born and raised in this valley. I find it more difficult now than I ever have for the democratization in the local ward. I find questions are looked upon as inappropriate, even impolite, and questions are not terribly honored. But we're not the only ones that have this problem. I know a member of the First Quorum of 70 that said he has no say either. And if you're not in an apostle's pocket, the way he put it, you don't go anywhere.
I think that's one reason that people are so afraid, because if they want to rise in leadership positions, they have to be very careful to kowtow, and people who want to speak out and change things in other ways are marginalized so much, and it's subtle, but it's very powerful.
You know, it's not theocracy so much that makes me afraid. I can follow a church that follows God and that believes in God. I think the real problem, from what I've heard, is people who randomly use their power without authority, without the right.
Or use authority in an inappropriate way.
Exactly. I mean, we can't read our handbook. We don't know what the rules are, and they almost want us to be in that position. And when you talk about things like that, you weren't allowed to use anything but hymns. Well, was that an arbitrary ruling made by a leader, or is that in the handbook? Is that a rule? If it's an arbitrary ruling, then that means that it's not you that's breaking the rules, it's the leader, by telling you that there's something that's a rule that isn't. And that's the thing that I found with when I was, as I've worked in different wards and stuff like that, that usually I'll work within the system, it's the leaders that go around it. And, you know, if you look at the case reports and at the chronicles of some of the abuses and stuff, the abuses are always the leaders doing something that isn't by the book. They go out of line, or however you want to put it. Janice Allred's excommunication was just, there were so many discrepancies in the way that they handled that case, and that were actually not by the book. And so that, I think, is the real problem, is our leaders are not following their own rules.
You know, I think what's frightening about the situation you bring up is that sometimes a leader will act in a way that I think is inappropriate, and people in a hierarchical position above that person will know and not come to the defense and be quiet, and it's, I think that's real cowardice. It's and the excuse that's often given is that we don't meddle in things on a local level. We let the local leaders, you bet they will interfere if it's something they don't want. But what they will do is let the person on the lower level do the dirty work, and then their hands are absolved of any crime. And I just think that is really...
And I've seen that so many times where that person on the lower level ends up being punished and held responsible for something, and the others wash their hands of it. Of course, like the leaders excommunicating Paul. You know, it's so many situations like that. And I think we need to almost hold our leaders to an accounting. We need to tell them, okay, they need to be accountable to their own rules. And if there's a rule that says, for example, you can only have hymns in stake meeting, let us write it down and vote on it.